we received in early childhood to shrink ourselves in order to make space for others. This is unfortunately something the society reinforces in girls and young women. To this day, writes feminist author Soraya L. Shamali on the website Role Reboot, when I sit in a chair, on a bus, a train, at a desk, I hear my primary school headmistress explain that ladies never cross their legs at the knees. The thought of sitting, arms stretched out on either side, on the top lip of the back of, say, a park bench, is laughable to me. It's so physically alien. Usually in public space, I fold myself up and try by habit to make room for others. Unconsciously, in our early childhood training, we are saying to our girl children, empty yourself, lack substance, embody frailty, be as small as possible, and we will love you more. To our boy children, we say, take up more room, more than is good for you or that you need, be as big as possible. There's some interesting new research from the Stanford University Graduate School of Business that shows how women leaders can use body language to come across as powerful at work without seeming overly dominant or aggressive. Because nonverbal behaviors work on a mostly subconscious level, people view a woman who uses strong and powerful body language at work less harshly than a woman who speaks in a strong and powerful way. My friend Jane Hansen, who was a news anchor for many years and is a communications expert, refers to this as woman spreading. Knowing that women are viewed as natural leaders when they take up more space, she encourages women to stand tall, uncross their legs, and drape their arms over their colleagues' chairs. Don't hesitate to take up more physical space at work. People will view you as a natural leader if you display physical confidence. This may feel completely foreign to you if you're used to camouflaging your body language, but with a little practice, it will start to come more naturally. Not long ago, I was at a board meeting during which one of my fellow board members, a man with a naturally strong voice, was being very talkative and had a lot of opinions. My voice was not as loud, and the only way I could get a word in edgewise would be by shouting, which I was not going to do. So I decided to stand up, walk around behind my chair, and then speak. This worked like a charm. He stopped talking and listened intently to what I said. When Jane told me about woman spreading, I realized that's exactly what I had been doing, and it had worked. Nice girl interrupted. Chances are that if you're a woman, you're very familiar with how it feels to be interrupted when you're speaking at work. This can be infuriating and demoralizing, and it's happened to me more times than I can count. In a 2017 article, the New York Times stated that being interrupted, talked over, shut down, or penalized for speaking out is nearly a universal experience for women when they are outnumbered by men. I'm sure this isn't news to you, so the question is, what can you do about it? I have found that focusing on my nonverbal communication has helped cut down on how often I'm interrupted at work. When I sit up straight or even stand up and force myself to take up a lot of space, make eye contact with whomever I'm speaking to, lean in, and remain extremely engaged, I find that I'm less likely to be cut off or interrupted. But of course, this does still happen to me from time to time. When it does, I kindly but firmly say, "Excuse me, I wasn't finished." Don't let yourself be interrupted. Take up space so that the people around you are forced to respect your presence. And if it still happens, have a line like this that you've rehearsed ahead of time so that you're always ready to speak up against being spoken over. Key takeaways. Failing to speak up in meetings can and will hold you back at work. Make a pact with yourself to voice a thought or opinion in every meeting you attend. Look out for speech weakeners. Reread your sent emails to make sure you don't say sorry for no reason or otherwise weaken your communication. When you disagree with a colleague, use your natural empathy to try and see the issue from their perspective before directly and clearly voicing your opinion. Remember, nonverbal communication is extremely important. Be cognizant of your posture, eye contact, and the amount of physical space you take up. Keep an eye out for other women who are sitting quietly in meetings and nicely encourage them to speak up too. Chapter 4. give feedback directly and kindly. When I was 27, I took on my first real managerial role as corporate controller at Coke. As a new manager, some aspects of the job came more naturally to me than others. One aspect I felt comfortable with right away was serving as a mentor and coach to my team members, and I fully embraced this part of the job. I made sure my team knew that they could come to me with challenges, and I'd act as a sounding board and supporter. Because of this, my team members saw that I truly cared about them and their careers, and knowing that they were happy in their roles made me feel good as their boss. It was all sunshine and rainbows until the first time I had to take on another new managerial responsibility, giving negative feedback. This was a huge shift for me, and I struggled with the idea of having to give tough feedback for a few reasons. First and foremost, as someone who deeply values kindness, I had a lot of empathy for my team members. I knew how hard it would be for them to hear critiques, and when I put myself in their shoes, I couldn't bear the thought of making them feel that way. Second, taking a negative tone just didn't come naturally to me. I was so much better at being the good cop, and acting tough felt wrong, like I was playing a role. At the same time, I knew that I couldn't be the good cop all the time, or I'd fall into the trap of being seen as a pushover. I was frankly stumped and worried that I would be seen as overly harsh or too mean if I gave my team straightforward feedback. With all these conflicting factors piling up around giving honest feedback, I did what any nice girl would do. I completely avoided it. The story you read in chapter 2 about me staying up all night to redo the presentation when my team members' contributions fell short is the perfect example of this. I just couldn't bring myself to give them feedback in a clear and straightforward way, and we all remember how that backfired on me. Soon enough, though, I had to find a way. Kira, a financial analyst on my team, was proving to be a weak link. She was very effective at financial reporting. I could count on her for accurate spreadsheets, charts, and tables that communicated the financial position of the company. That part was great. There were two problems, however. First, Kira never delivered her reports on time. And second, the accompanying write-up explaining the financial results was usually poorly written, full of grammatical errors, and failed to clearly communicate the financial picture the way I needed it to. For months, I had avoided giving Kira direct feedback. Instead, I rewrote all of her copy, and when Kira inevitably sent me the numbers at the very last minute, I pulled all-nighters to get the cleaned-up reports to my boss on time. Yet, I knew this approach was not sustainable. If I continued to say nothing, the next quarter would be the same, and the one after that, and the one after that. Even worse, if my team knew they could hand in sloppy work and I'd simply redo it, I'd be undermining my own authority as their boss. I'd be the walking definition of a people pleaser. I couldn't let that happen. I needed to give Kira real, constructive feedback, but I didn't know how to do it in a kind way that felt authentic to me. I went to my boss and explained the bind I felt I was in. He told me that I was actually doing Kira a disservice by cleaning up her work rather than being direct with her about her performance. He urged me to address the issue head on. He also suggested that maybe the reason Kira was consistently late in submitting her reports was because she was getting stuck on the writing. He recommended that I start my conversation with Kira by addressing the missed deadlines and see if the writing challenges came up naturally. Emboldened by this advice, I thought back to the feedback I'd gotten from bosses throughout my own career and how their different approaches had made me feel. Two different experiences stood out to me right away, both with team leads at Ernst & Young. One of them launched immediately into negative feedback during my performance review in a way that was really startling and hard to process. Yet she did a good job of clearly communicating what needed to change and pointing to specific examples. I left that meeting feeling a bit deflated, but knowing exactly what I needed to do to improve. The other team lead, however, started my performance review by telling me how much she valued me. She asked me questions and didn't rush through the meeting. This conversation felt like much more of a dialogue. Yet, I left feeling as though she hadn't really pinpointed any areas for potential growth. The conversation was more pleasant, but it wasn't nearly as constructive. As I thought about this, it struck me that I could combine these two approaches, the directness of my first team lead with the kindness of the second. If I gave Kira feedback that was nice and direct, it would feel natural to me and hopefully help Kira improve her performance without crushing her spirit. It was a matter of giving her feedback in an empathetic and supportive way by presenting it as helpful advice rather than as a harsh critique. This new mindset allowed me to give feedback while drawing on the skills like empathy and compassion that felt authentic to me. Newly confident in my approach, it was so much easier for me to have that formerly daunting conversation with Kira. I began our conversation with a positive, which was that she was doing a great job on the numbers. It was easy to praise her on this because it was true. Then I moved on to the missed deadlines. I told her that I wanted to be helpful to her and that I wanted to understand what was driving the late behavior. But I also wanted her to know that her missing deadlines was creating a burden for the team. As soon as I brought it up, amazingly, Kira seemed relieved. My kindly worded feedback gave her an opening to admit that she did not enjoy the writing part of the report. She told me that while she always had the numbers prepared well in advance, she struggled to get through the commentary. We spoke about whether her writing was something that she wanted to work on improving, or if she wanted to transition to a quantitative-only role, where she could create the most value for the company and for herself. The conversation ended up being a huge relief for both Kira and for me, and it completely changed the way I thought about providing tough feedback. I now see feedback as almost a kind of gift to the other person. It's also a gift to myself as a manager. If I hadn't spoken to Kira when I did, I probably would have spent months redoing her work and holding it against her. It was much better for both of us to have that conversation. Most important, by learning that even negative feedback can be approached with a real sense of empathy, I was able to leverage my authentic kindness in a way that was productive for my team and for me. Stephanie Kaplan-Lewis, the co-founder of Her Campus Media, recently shared a story with me about her kind approach to giving negative feedback. She had to give a very tough performance review to an employee whom she liked a lot and was quite close with, but who just wasn't performing. Stephanie made sure to cite specific examples to illustrate the critique she was making so that the critiques didn't feel too personal or unsubstantiated. She also made sure to mention those elements of the job this person had done well and the strengths she saw in her. While the review was a tough one, the message throughout was that Stephanie was confident in her employee's ability to improve and had every intention of working with her to make sure her next review was nothing like this one. The employee responded incredibly well and left the review motivated to make changes. Only 4 months later, she had made enormous improvements and was on track to get a promotion, rather than checking out after a bad review. Stories like this motivate me to continue striving to balance my kindness and directness whenever I have to give the gift of constructive and specific feedback. Your brain on feedback. If you're not yet in a managerial role or can't even imagine a time when you will be, it's still important to think about how to communicate feedback. It speaks to the larger struggle that many women face when trying to balance being nice and strong at work. As you can imagine, I'm not the only woman who's ever had a hard time giving constructive feedback. Yet it's something we must learn to do. As Dawn Casal, the founder of One Girl Cookies, says, "If I have to have a difficult conversation and don't have it, I'm sending the message, feel free to take advantage of me." Here are some of the responses the women I surveyed had to say about the issue of negative feedback. "I constantly find myself editing what I want to say to make sure I'm not coming across as mean or critical when I'm just trying to help my team perform better. It really bothers me that this is something male bosses don't seem to have to worry about. If I don't give tough feedback, I worry that I'll be seen as a pushover. So I always go out of my way to deliver the news like my male bosses would, with no emotion or sugarcoating. I'm not a manager, but I have such a hard time giving feedback to the colleagues I have to collaborate with. I just don't know how to do it." Their comments got me thinking. Why do so many of the female bosses I've worked with seem to struggle with giving feedback more than their male counterparts? Of course, there is the understandable concern that they'll be perceived as overly harsh or bitchy if they don't sugarcoat the news. But research points to an added factor that lies in how male and female brains function. There is an emerging field of study looking into the differences between how male and female brains are wired. A 2016 study from the University of Pennsylvania looked at the brain connectivity of 2,000 healthy people. They found that female brains typically had far more gray matter in the hippocampus, the part of the brain that plays a role in forming memories, and the left caudate, part of the brain that controls social cognition. The study concluded that this apportioning of gray matter is why women in general tend to be better at intuiting how others are feeling and knowing how to respond. This field of research is controversial because of concerns that studies like this can be used to perpetuate stereotypes. It should also be said that not all women have a typical female brain, and not all men have a typical male brain. But I do think that the study can help us learn how to make the most of our inherent abilities. When I read about this study, it helped me understand why I had such a hard time confronting Kira. I was intuiting how the negative feedback might make her feel. However, when I changed the way I thought about giving feedback from a critique that would cause her pain to a form of support, my natural empathy actually became an asset because I knew how to respond to ease her pain. As I learned through my conversation with Kira, when you leverage your kindness to give feedback empathetically, these conversations become more pleasant for everyone involved. In addition, science actually backs up the fact that this approach is more effective. As you'll see in this brief but interesting detour into neurology, this is in part because of the way the human brain works. Like all animals, humans have a part of the brain called the amygdala. It's like a guard dog sleeping with one eye open, alert for any possible threats. If your amygdala senses a threat, it turns on your body's fight or flight response, which sets off a cascade of hormonal reactions that cause you to become angry, fight, want to run away, flight, or shut down like a deer in a car's headlights, freeze. The amygdala is meant to protect us when we are confronted by a physical threat, such as the threat of being hit by a car while walking across the street. When you see a car speeding toward you, your amygdala takes over, cutting off access to your more analytic prefrontal cortex. This prompts you to run instinctively and without thinking. That's a good thing. After all, in the face of imminent danger, you don't want to stand there thinking, should I run or not? Let me just take a minute to weigh the pros and cons. Unfortunately, the amygdala isn't very good at distinguishing between real and perceived threats. Our fight or flight response can be triggered in all sorts of non-life-threatening situations. This is why we often find ourselves in situations where we make comments we regret later, fight. Avoid working through a situation, flight. Or suddenly disengage mentally, which sometimes means that we will literally not be able to recall what was said, freeze. According to David Rock, founder of the NeuroLeadership Institute, there are five types of social threats that can trigger this response, all of which you can easily imagine coming up at work. Status, a threat to your reputation in the group. Certainty, a threat to your ability to count on what you thought you could count on. Autonomy, a threat to your ability to do things your way. Relatedness, a threat to your sense of yourself as a friend rather than a foe. Fairness, a threat to your sense of fair play. According to Rock, performance evaluations usually trigger a sense of threat in one or more of these categories, causing someone who receives anything but positive feedback to become angry, feel demotivated, or fail to take in anything you've said to them. But when you tap into your empathy to give constructive feedback, you avoid triggering this threat response in the other person. Ultimately, this increases that person's ability to take in what you say, protect your relationship with them, and helps improve an employee's performance without shattering their confidence. How to give empathetic feedback. In the years since my conversation with Kira, I've given constructive feedback hundreds of times. Along the way, I've learned more and more about how to leverage my empathy and kindness to make these conversations as pleasant and effective as possible. You can do this by following these steps. And if you're not in a managerial role yet, remember that you can use these same techniques for delivering any type of disappointing or difficult news. Frame it positively. Presentation here is everything. Remember, the need to give feedback is not a problem. It's a normal part of the managerial process. So don't frame the conversation in a negative light by saying things like, here are some issues I'm seeing in your performance, or here are some areas I'm finding that are challenging for you. Instead, make it clear that you're not disappointed in this person. You're their biggest champion, and you're just trying to help them succeed even more. You can do this by saying, "I have some advice that might help you," or "I have some constructive feedback for you." To reduce the threat to the other person's status, I always frame the problem in a positive context by focusing first on what my team member is doing right. This approach is often referred to as a praise sandwich, and it's very effective. Rather than implying everything is wrong, I come from the direction of a lot is going well, but there are some things that need improvement. For this reason, I began my talk with Kira by discussing how great she was at pulling together the financial data. This positive start put her at ease so that the rest of our conversation could be truly constructive. I often follow this by allowing the other person to voice the problem by saying something like, "What are some areas you'd like to focus on improving?" In many cases, they already know where they're falling short. When they say it first, it becomes something we are working on together instead of a criticism that I'm directing at them. This practice allows me to shift into my natural state of acting as a mentor and source of support and eliminates any sense of threat entirely. I tell them straight out, "I want to see you succeed, and I'm here to support you." This is a strong and motivating position for any authentically kind leader. Don't get personal. I always make sure to separate the person from the situation. In other words, I can have negative feelings about behavior or performance, but I still need to show empathy and support for the person. This in turn causes them to look at the problem from a more productive and less defensive or guilty perspective. To get into this objective mindset, I focus on the facts and the behavior I'd like to see in the future, instead of making any emotional statements or blaming the other person for what's happened in the past. I also frame my questions carefully. Instead of asking Kira, "What do you think you could have done differently?" I asked, "What do you think could have been done differently?" Jenny Fleiss, the co-founder of Rent the Runway, says, "Starting a critical feedback conversation by asking questions and giving an employee the chance to share thoughts on how he or she feels they have performed up front has often led to their addressing an issue or topic on their own and ultimately a nicer and more effective outcome." I completely agree, and this subtle change shifts the tone of the conversation from feeling like a personal attack that neither of you wants to be involved in to a more meaningful dialogue. Provide as much context as possible. Rather than just demanding that an employee redo her work, I always make sure to explain exactly why I'm asking him or her to do something. This is a strategy that I learned from one of my bosses at Time Inc., who was excellent at giving me the big picture first, and then tying in how I can be more effective at supporting that bigger picture. It's so important that an employee understands the why behind your feedback, as well as everything you ask him or her to do. This is one way for a boss to keep her team motivated in a kind yet effective way, while striving to meet high standards. For example, I remember preparing a strategic review with Liz White, who was a crucial member of my team when I was at Time Inc. When Liz sent me a draft of her presentation, the formatting of the financial section was a bit off. I wanted her to fix it, but I knew this might come across as really nitpicky and annoying. So instead of giving her a complaint, I gave her the greater context. If your financials are misaligned or look sloppy, it can give people a lack of confidence in your numbers, I told her. You don't want to give them any reason to question the numbers. Once she understood exactly why this was so important, Liz was happy to fix the formatting issues, and it was something that came more and more naturally to her going forward. Do it in person. We're all so busy that it can be extremely tempting to pick up the phone or even just fire off an email to give quick feedback. But I've seen over and over again that it's so important to have these conversations in person. This goes back to the way our brains work. We have specialized brain cells called mirror neurons that only fire when we're in the presence of another person. When you are with another person, you observe their behavior, and your mirror neurons fire, mirroring that behavior so that you feel as if you have acted in the same way. This process allows us to pick up on the emotional intention of whomever we are speaking to in a way that is simply impossible over the phone or via email. I've made this mistake myself on more than one occasion. One of my team members named Susan once sent me a press release over email that had a lot of problems. I knew that I should wait and talk to her about it in person, but I was swamped and I wanted to get it over with. So I just picked up the phone and called her. Even though I followed all of my other advice above, the conversation didn't go well. Susan couldn't sense my empathy or compassion over the phone, and she became upset. But the worst part was that I didn't even notice this at the time because I couldn't read her body language either. It wasn't until I saw Susan's face at a group meeting later that afternoon that I realized how upset she really was. We're all going a million miles a minute, and it's often so hard to find time to sit down face to face. But after what happened with Susan, I thought back to the best leaders I'd worked with and found that they all somehow managed to do this. One of my bosses at Time Inc. often popped into my office, asked whether I had a spare minute, and dispensed some valuable advice. My experience with Susan taught me that meeting face-to-face is one of the most important aspects of delivering empathetic feedback, and something you can never shortcut. It's the only way to ensure that the other person picks up on your sincerity and kindness. Plus, it leads them to mirror this authenticity. This is where niceness truly feels like a superpower. It causes actual positive changes in other people just by interacting with them in person. So by being sincere and authentic with people, you are automatically encouraging the same behavior in them, even in the midst of the most challenging conversations. If you work remotely, having these conversations over video conference is better than giving feedback over the phone, or even worse, over email. Be specific without micromanaging. A huge challenge for some female bosses is to delegate appropriately and give specific feedback without being seen as a micromanager. There is yet another double standard at work here. Author and sociologist B.J. Gallagher has observed that the same characteristics that are accepted and even welcomed in male leaders are often resented in female ones. For example, while a male boss is seen as being attentive to details, a female who acts the same way is seen as picky. And as a result, female bosses have an unfair reputation for being micromanagers. I've seen some female leaders go too far in the other direction to avoid playing into the stereotype. Instead of getting into the nitty-gritty details and risk being accused of micromanaging, they give feedback that's too vague. Over the years, I've learned to strike a balance here by providing specific feedback while focusing on the broad strokes. By that, I mean stating the one or two specific areas where the other person missed the mark without getting too far into the weeds. Call in the experts. Sometimes, particular feedback can be so sticky or delicate that it may be better for the other person to hear it from an impartial third party. This is not the same as avoiding the issue. I actually see it as a form of kindness. Some feedback is simply easier to take in when it comes from someone you don't have a relationship with and won't have to face in the office every day. I had a situation like this with a woman on my team who had been accused of suffering from the dreaded condition we all know as resting bitch face. Look, this term is sexist in and of itself. I sit in meetings all the time with men who have an angry or dispassionate look on their faces, and everyone just assumes they're thinking about something deep and brilliant. But when a woman has a near identical expression, she's viewed as unpleasant and nasty. Unfortunately, in this case, I had several people from other departments coming to me and complaining that this person brought the whole room down with her facial expressions. I was torn. On the one hand, I did not want to force her to change something about herself that a man would never have to worry about. What was I going to do? Tell her to smile more? That's so incredibly sexist and infuriating. But at the same time, I had to face the fact that this was negatively affecting her performance because people literally did not want her around. Eventually, I decided to hire a media coach to give my entire team some tips on how to present themselves well in meetings and interviews. And I had a conversation with the coach ahead of time about the feedback I'd received about this particular team member. In this case, I thought it would be too painful and unfair for me to deliver this feedback myself, no matter how kind or empathetic I may have been. It would be less insulting coming from a neutral third party who is seen as an expert in this field. No, I don't believe that women should be sitting in meetings, worrying about our facial expressions, instead of focusing on being as creative and effective as possible. But in that delicate situation, I had to find the most tactful way possible to let my team member know that she was being judged, however unfairly, by the way she presented herself at work. 5 nice ways to assertively communicate bad news. 1. Body language matters. Sit up straight and maintain eye contact throughout the conversation, no matter how difficult it may be. 2. Make sure your facial expression matches the content of your conversation. Don't fire someone with a big fake smile on your face. 3. Begin your sentences with I. 4. Remember to pause after speaking and to stay silent during those gaps in conversation in order to give the other person time to respond. 5. Be clear on what you want to communicate and how you'll communicate it before you go into the conversation. You might even try practicing in front of the mirror or writing out a script. Balancing positive to negative feedback. Obviously, giving my team positive feedback and praise has always come more naturally to me than sharing constructive feedback. This is where I've been able to really draw on my relational skills to create a bond with my team. But I've had to be careful not to slide toward being a people pleaser by throwing compliments around so much that they become meaningless. When an authentically nice leader constantly tells her employees how great they are, she may be seen as someone they can walk all over. Throughout my career, I have relied on the following techniques to strike the balance between being positive and supportive, yet maintaining high expectations. Take a 10-to-1 shot. My sister, Josephine DiPolito, told me years ago that her boss, the textile designer, Carolyn Ray, said that when you're managing people, you have to give 10 attaboys for every one aw shit. This doesn't mean that you should literally give 10 pieces of praise for every bit of criticism. The idea is that it motivates employees when you make sure the positives outweigh the negatives. I was surprised to find that there's actually research backing this up. A study in the Harvard Business Review showed that the highest performing teams received 6 pieces of praise for every piece of criticism. Be specific. Instead of heaping general praise on your team, tell them specifically what you appreciate about their work. For example, I really like the way you thought that through. Or, I really like that you pressure tested this idea before bringing it to me. Or, I appreciate the fact that you got input from industry thought leaders. Correlate their actions to the results you want. This is not only kind, but also a positive and focused way to motivate your team to do excellent work. Save it. Be careful not to dilute the impact of your praise by handing it out too much. I try to save my praise for the end of a large project or initiative instead of saying it every day. This is how I balance being nice without being seen as too nice or fake. At the end of an initiative, even if the outcome isn't exactly what I wanted, I make sure to praise my team's effort and acknowledge that they did everything they could to get a positive result. Serve it up early. On the other hand, when I have a new person on my team, I like to help them get an early win to boost their confidence. I also encourage my team to do this for each other. This can be something really simple and straightforward. For example, when one of my assistants started at Time Inc., I realized that we didn't have a team directory. I asked her to put one together with everyone's name, picture, and contact info. It was an easy task, but once it was done, the directory was extremely useful to have. At the next all-hands meeting, I shared the directory with the team and said, "Katie put this together. It's going to be really helpful." Everyone clapped and Katie beamed. I think this moment gave her the confidence to start at her new job with a bang. Moreover, this is the kind of positive action that a boss who undervalues kindness would never think to do. I always think about this when someone tries to tell me that being nice at work is a liability and not an asset. The receiving end of feedback. When I was at Time Inc., my team wanted to create a new iPhone app for one of our brands, and we needed a financial investment to make it happen. My team put a lot of time and effort into creating a brief presentation that we then took to the CFO and CEO to ask for the money to create the app. The answer was no. I walked out of the room after the pitch meeting with a peer chatting about what had just happened. I felt defeated and deflated. We should have presented more comps, I said, but my colleague was undeterred. I bet we can tweak a few things and go back in and pitch again, he said. It struck me that I was being too sensitive and too hard on myself. I cared so much about getting it right the first time that I took it badly when things didn't go well. Then I wasted time beating myself up when I could have been moving on to my next win. Sound familiar? This intense emotional investment in our work is a wonderful sentiment, but it can make receiving negative feedback extremely difficult. I experienced this again in another situation at Time Inc. when I made the mistake of trying too hard to be helpful and low maintenance. Yes, I admit it, I was being a people pleaser. My boss wanted me to write a strategic plan for one of our brands, and she gave me a couple of months to get it done. I thought I knew what she wanted, and I didn't want to bother her, so I never checked in with her to make sure I was on the right track. Instead, I wrote a 40-page PowerPoint deck all by myself. She looked at it for the first time on the day of the presentation in front of the entire team and said, "This is not what I wanted at all. You totally missed the boat." I was devastated. I left the room, slammed the door, and went into the bathroom to cry. A friend of mine found me in there and said, "I understand why you're upset, but honestly, you're going to have to develop a thicker skin. It's not personal, it's business." For me, just hearing those words made all the difference. I was able to learn from this mistake. Of course I should have checked in with my boss before the day of the presentation. And just like when I gave feedback to my team, I learned to separate the person from the facts. The fact was that I had screwed up, but that didn't make me a screw up. This was a crucial distinction. Earlier, I suggested taking the initiative and simplifying spreadsheets and presentations for your boss before showing them to him or her. But this time my mistake was taking too much initiative. The difference was, this wasn't just a matter of consolidating information that already existed. I was creating a strategic plan from scratch, which was a huge undertaking. Plus, it was the first time I was doing something like this, so I definitely should have checked in with my boss early on in the process to make sure I was on the right track. If you're ever in doubt about whether or not to solicit feedback, try asking your boss, "Would you like to see an early version of this before I deliver the final draft?" Or, "How often would you like me to check in with you while I'm working on this?" Over time, this mistake and many others have taught me to develop a growth mindset. Carol Dweck, a professor of psychology at Stanford, differentiates between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. People who have a growth mindset believe that through training and hard work, their talents can be developed, while those with a fixed mindset believe that their talents are innate gifts that cannot be changed. Dweck's research shows that people with a growth mindset achieve more because they focus on learning. In many ways, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you believe you can get better at something, it's more likely that you will. When it comes to receiving feedback, then, developing a growth mindset is a huge help. Instead of criticism, it will feel like an opportunity for growth. And whether you're on the giving or receiving end of feedback, it's important to allow your empathy to rise to the surface. When you put yourself in the other person's shoes, you can see that the person critiquing you is merely trying to help. To cry or not to cry. A lot has been said and written about women who cry at work, whether or not it's appropriate and if it will be held against you if you do it. I'm not saying it's the best idea, but I'll certainly admit to having cried at work a few times. I've also been the person who other women have cried to at work more times than I can count. Afterwards, they often feel guilty, as if they failed or have shown too much weakness. I don't think it's a sign of weakness when a woman gets emotional at work. In fact, when my high-performing team members have cried to me, it's shown me how much they really cared about getting it right. That's a good thing. But that doesn't mean that you should cry or vent to your boss over every little mishap. If you feel yourself getting emotional about feedback you've received or upset about something that happened at work, it's not the end of the world. You can say, "Wow, I really was not expecting that. I need some time to collect myself, but then I would like to talk through this some more." Then go and call someone you love outside of work and let it out. Don't let your emotions build up inside of you, or they will come out in other ways and hinder your performance. After I've vented to a friend or family member, I feel so much better and can think more clearly about how to continue the conversation in a much more stable and professional way. But I still don't go back right away. Instead, I sleep on it and see how I feel in the morning. Most of the time, I'm already over it by the next day and ready to move on. If you do this and yet something is still bothering you and it's getting in the way of your contributions, it's important to communicate it. Many of the young women I mentor would never dream of having this type of conversation with their boss, but it's important to stand up for yourself to make sure you can do your best work. One woman I mentor named Lynn was dealing with a situation just like this. The team she was leading was creating a new program for their online educational software, and they had decided on a feature that was going to be included in the program. But then without any warning to Lynn, her boss announced to the entire team that they weren't going to include that feature. She felt, and rightly so, that this had undermined her authority with her team. And after taking some distance and venting to her family, she was still very upset about it. I encouraged Lynn to talk to her boss. She was concerned about how to do this in a way that would not be perceived as whiny or overly sensitive. So I told her to frame it in the context of why this would prevent her from doing the best job she could for the company and to use all the same techniques I described earlier about how to give feedback empathetically. We sat down and together developed the following script. I've been struggling with something that I need to talk to you about. This is not an easy conversation to have with you, but I think it's important for our relationship and for my contributions to the company as a whole. When you told my team that you decided not to include the feature in the new program, I felt it undermined my credibility with my team. This makes it difficult for me to be an effective manager if they're going to question my decision-making. Lynn used the script, and her boss responded positively. In fact, Lynn reported to me later that their relationship was stronger than ever. Her success proved to me that when you allow your empathy to guide you and use the techniques in this chapter to balance it with criticism, you can give kind yet straightforward feedback to an employee and a boss alike. And by adopting a growth mindset, you'll be able to see constructive feedback as a way to develop your own skills even more. Key takeaways. Empathy can be an asset when giving feedback if you balance it with specific comments and context, so the other person has a clear understanding of what needs to change and why. When giving feedback, remember to let positive reinforcement outweigh negative criticisms. Research shows that the highest performing teams receive 6 pieces of praise for every piece of criticism. Receiving feedback is an opportunity to grow and develop, not a sign of a problem. Instead of beating yourself up for the things you haven't done perfectly, focus on how you can truly work on improving your performance by using the feedback you have received. Chapter 5. Make decisions firmly and collaboratively. When I think about the tough decisions I've had to make over my career, one in particular comes to mind. When I was at Time Inc., we launched a site called StyleFind, a shopping website curated by InStyle editors. It was a big undertaking that required a significant investment of money and resources, but it just didn't work. For a while, we let it flounder. StyleFind was my baby. I had been the one to ask for all that investment to get it started, and I was worried that if we shut it down, I would be seen as a failure, and it would be my scarlet letter. After 2 years of watching it struggle, I had to decide whether we should invest even more time and resources into StyleFind to try and make it succeed, or just cut our losses and let it go. In addition to worrying about how this decision would affect my own career, I was concerned about how it would affect the company and the rest of my team. I'd always thought that tapping into my natural empathy had given me an edge in business because it helped me build relationships, loyalty, and trust. But now I wondered if when it came to making tough decisions, empathy was more of a liability. There's a widely accepted myth that nice girls are wishy-washy and have difficulty making decisions because they spend too much time worrying about what other people think. It's true that because we have empathy for others, we are keenly aware of how our actions impact them and their lives. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it can be an enormous strength as a leader if wielded strategically. The trick here, of course, is to strike a balance between being empathetic and being a worrier. Unable to call the shots because you're so worried about how your decisions will affect others. Yes, it's essential to think everything through from multiple perspectives and collect buy-in and advice from colleagues. But at the end of the day, a leader has to be able to stand in his or her own shoes, make a clear decision, and then own the results of that decision. As I mentioned earlier, empathy turning into worry is definitely my Achilles heel. And so throughout my career, it has been especially important for me to develop concrete and well-planned strategies to help me act more decisively. This is not easy, and I know plenty of others who have struggled with this as well. Take a look at what some of the women I surveyed had to say. I think that women who are decisive get unfairly labeled as bossy, so I tend to shy away from making big decisions at work. I like to ask a lot of people for their opinions before making a decision, but then I worry that people will hold it against me if I don't take their advice. Sometimes I think that if I ask for advice, I'll be seen as weak or ineffective, so I try to make most of my decisions without seeking any input from others. But I wonder if I could be making more informed decisions if I did it another way. Develop evidence-based confidence. To make tough decisions, you need to have the confidence that you are capable of making a smart, informed, and effective choice. A lot has been written about women and confidence, but I've noticed that there are two key components lacking from that discussion. A clear idea of where confidence comes from and what distinguishes confidence from ego. True confidence is not something that you are simply born with. It's a skill you can develop by paying close attention to your successes in life and how you accomplish them. This purposeful self-reflection will result in the type of evidence-based confidence that does not come across as arrogant or pushy. On the other hand, when someone is full of self-importance and walks around believing that they are just generally wonderful without seeming to need real evidence to back it up, well, that's not confidence. That's just ego. Several years ago, I was interviewing with an influential woman who commented that I had a quiet self-confidence. At first, I wasn't sure what she meant or whether it was even a compliment. Was she saying that I was demure and passive? That wasn't what I wanted to project. But she explained that she wanted people on her team who would contribute significantly without letting their egos get in the way. As I listened, I realized that she was describing the type of confidence that's grounded in experience. To this day, when I'm struggling with a decision or feeling insecure, I go back to the evidence. Not long ago, I was giving a big speech to 300 managers and I was quite nervous. A close friend told me, "Think back and remember a time when you gave a good speech." It was simple but solid advice. Before delivering that big presentation, I thought back to a speech I'd given a few years before that my team said had really resonated with them. I visualized that speech in as much detail as I could possibly remember. What I'd said, how I said it, and what it had felt like to succeed. This made me feel far more confident. When I was facing the decision of whether or not to shut down StyleFind, I remembered this mental approach. I thought back to tough decisions I'd made in the past that ended up having great outcomes, and I examined the process I'd used to make those decisions. I realized that in every case, I'd taken in all of the necessary data and then ended up going with my gut. Not my brain, not my heart, but my gut. That was the process that worked for me. And knowing that allowed me to move forward using that technique to make a decision with confidence. Many other leaders also tap into evidence-based confidence to make tough decisions. My friend Mindy Grossman, currently the CEO of Weight Watchers, took a very public risk when she took HSNI, the parent company of HSN and Cornerstone Brands, public, back when she was their CEO in 2008, just as the economic meltdown was unfolding. Mindy had to convince consumers, employees, and the board to take a chance with her. She told me that she never could have done that if she hadn't already built a solid network of people who believed in her. This is where being authentically kind and transparent paid off in a big way for Mindy. These people trusted her and were willing to take a major risk with her. Still, when the time came closer, Mindy admitted that she had some fears. She told me that she remembers standing out on the terrace thinking, "Can I do this? 6,000 employees are counting on me. In that moment, Mindy went back to her evidence-based confidence. She reminded herself of all the detailed due diligence she had done before making the decision to move ahead. Reflecting on all of that hard work gave her the inner confidence to believe in herself and what she was doing. To develop your own evidence-based confidence, ask yourself the following questions. When have I done something difficult and survived? When have I made wise choices? What process have I used when making successful decisions? Then move forward, making your decision with confidence by using the following techniques. Fill in the gaps. It's obviously important to seek advice from others when making a decision, but how many people, and specifically which ones? It turns out that there are physiological differences in the ways women and men respond to stressful situations. And yes, having to make a tough decision at work can certainly trigger a stress response. While men typically go into fight or flight mode when faced with a stressor, women tend to seek out social groups during times of stress. Psychologists refer to this as the tend and befriend stress response. Studies show that women's brains release more of a hormone called oxytocin in response to stress than men's. Oxytocin makes us feel good about social interaction, causing women to seek out friends during times of stress. In part, because of this response to stress, many of us go to our closest friends and family members when facing a tough decision. But are they really best equipped to give you an informed opinion? Not always. Instead of going to those closest to me, the first thing I do when making a decision is to try and figure out what kind of expertise I'm currently missing. Then I put together a team I can call on for advice that fills the gaps in my experience and knowledge. This allows me to hear multiple perspectives, but in a focused and purposeful way that doesn't delay or derail my decision-making. I've often shared the strategy to help other women avoid the pitfall of seeking input from too many people. When one of the female startup founders I was working with recently as an advisor had a big decision to make, she went to dozens of investors, mostly male, for advice. Not only was this extremely time-consuming, but it was also off-target. The product she was developing was an app geared toward young girls, and the men she'd gone to for advice didn't really get what she was doing and gave her conflicting and often overly critical advice. This left her doubting her decisions and completely stuck. I told her, "This is where you have to be the boss. You started this company, so you get to decide whom you're going to listen to. Does it make sense for you to listen to advice from people who are not your target demographic or experts in what you're trying to do?" I explained that when it comes to seeking advice, more is not necessarily better. Instead, it's important to be strategic about who you seek advice from. Together, we devised a list of three types of expertise she needed. Someone who knew the existing market for her target age group, someone with a background in building new technologies, and someone who really knew how to market to young girls. The advice she received from these three experts was much more in line with her plans and allowed her to make an informed decision that she felt confident about. Ultimately, feeling confident in your decisions should be the goal of every woman who wants to be inclusive and decisive. In contrast to this founder, I've observed some women fight their instincts to tend and befriend and try to make decisions without seeking any outside opinions. They want to appear strong and confident, and of course, they don't want to bother anyone by taking up his or her time, so as a result, they act unilaterally. But in reality, acting alone is simply impractical. No one expects you to already know everything. Even the most experienced world leaders still have gaps in their knowledge, and they call in the experts when making tough decisions. That's what we should be doing too. Don't ever feel like you're putting yourself in a weak position by asking for help. As a boss, whenever junior members of my team came to me with an idea or opinion and backed it up by saying that they had spoken to an expert beforehand, it struck me as being resourceful and smart. If anything, seeking outside expertise adds strength to your argument, not weakness. Have a go-to team. The people you pull in to round out your knowledge may vary from decision to decision. But it's just as important to have two or three people whom you know you can turn to for advice about anything. These people aren't necessarily experts in this particular area. Instead, they are individuals who know your values intimately and can help keep you grounded. They'll ask the tough questions that will really force you to think. The important thing here is to keep this team small, 3 to 4 people maximum, and make sure they'll give you honest feedback, help you stand strong in your own opinions, and encourage you to stand up and do the right thing. My go-to team consists of my husband, my dear friend and former colleague, Patricia Karpis, and my business coach, MJ Ryan, who I've been working with for 7 years. For me, this is a good balance because it consists of someone who knows me personally, my husband, someone who has worked with me, Patricia, and someone who is deeply invested in my business goals and priorities, MJ. Earlier in my career, when I did not have a business coach, I relied on a mentor to fill this role. I never know which member of my go-to team will end up asking the questions that will spark my ultimate decision. When I was at Time Inc., I had to let several employees go on the same day as part of a restructuring. This was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. That morning, I reached out to each of the employees who were being let go and set up a time to meet with them that same day so they weren't left waiting for too long, wondering if it was bad news. Then I had each conversation in that person's own office, so they had the comfort of being on their own turf, and I could leave them in peace to collect their thoughts after the conversation was over. At the start of each meeting, I said, "I have some bad news," to let them know right away what was happening, and then I simply shared the news and listened to their reaction. These conversations were difficult, and I was also worried about how the rest of the team would react. Yes, they still had their jobs, but restructuring is stressful for everyone. I wasn't sure how to communicate with the rest of the team that was left behind after the layoffs were done. The way I saw it, I had 3 options. I could let each individual manager handle it with their team. I could say and do nothing and simply wait for the CEO to send out a company-wide email. Or I could gather everyone in the room at the end of the day and talk with them about what had happened. The third option would definitely be the most difficult after a draining day. But when I spoke to MJ, she said, "Fran, think about what kind of leader you are and what's most important to you." I immediately knew that since building solid relationships was one of my core values, the most authentic thing for me would be to pull everyone together and talk directly with them. Make no mistake, it was still difficult to face the room, but making this decision ahead of time made it easier for me because I had my talking points planned and practiced before I went into the room. And having the emotional support and validation that came from talking it over with someone I trusted helped me feel confident about what I was doing. This ended up being the right decision because it allowed me to protect my relationships with my remaining team, help them feel secure in their jobs, and make sure they remained emotionally invested in the company. Pull in the stakeholders. As a leader, I found it effective to get input from the people who will be directly affected by my decisions, even if they are more junior than me. There have been times in my career when people have accused me of being too nice for doing this. They said I would appear weak if I gave the individuals who reported to me too much input, but I saw it differently. To me, my team consisted of stakeholders who were totally invested in my decisions. I was liable to them, so I always got their input while still making it clear that in the end, the ultimate decision would rest with me. A woman I advised named Vanessa was recently setting up the office space for the company she'd founded, and she'd hired a consultant to design an open floor plan for her 40-person staff. Vanessa asked my opinion on the floor plan, and my first question to her was, "Have you asked your staff what they think? They're the ones who will be working in this environment every day." Vanessa resisted this idea at first. She thought she would be seen as a pushover if she asked for their input. I told her instead to think of her staff as a focus group and to ask one person from each department. She followed my advice and ended up gaining some significant suggestions. In particular, the representative from the sales department noted that they need private space in order to feel comfortable making sales calls. So Vanessa added several private offices to the open floor plan for the sales team to duck into to make calls. Her team ended up being far more productive because they had what they needed to succeed and felt that they'd been heard. Far from being seen as a pushover, Vanessa was able to be inclusive and decisive and actually gain respect from her team. Once you make the decision, thank everyone you've consulted for his or her input. Acknowledge that your decision is not going to make everyone happy, but express that you feel strongly that it's the right direction. And at the end of the day, it's better to make a decision so you can all move on.